from the Sky News Centre at 6. A man who pledged allegiance to IS has been sentenced to a minimum of 30 years for plotting to murder the Prime Minister. The judge at the Old Bailey called Naima Rahman, originally from Birmingham, a very dangerous individual. Frank Field has been told he faces expulsion from Labour if he doesn't withdraw his resignation of the party whip. He's been told he'll be ejected in 2 weeks if he doesn't reverse his decision. The veteran politician has accused the Labour leadership of becoming a force for anti-Semitism in British politics. Our political correspondent Laura Bundock says he's been given two options.
I absolutely want to remain a member of the party, Frank Field said. He described the meeting as cordial, but these are the options left to him, basically, withdraw his resignation or he will be thrown out of the Labour Party.
An investigation into baby deaths at a Shropshire hospital is being expanded after more families came forward. A review's examining failings within maternity services at the Shropshire and Telford Hospital NHS Trust. Homebase is closing 42 stores, putting around 1,500 jobs at risk after reaching a deal with creditors. The struggling DIY store was sold earlier this year for just £1. A ticket reselling website is facing legal action in the High Court after being accused of breaking consumer laws. The Competition and Markets Authority says an investigation found Viagogo had failed to change the way it does business. Ariana Grande's been paying a musical tribute to the Queen of Soul at her funeral service. Mourners at the church in Detroit rose to their feet, clapping and singing along. Earlier, Faith Hill honoured Aretha Franklin with a rendition of What a Friend We Have in Jesus. Other stars at the service include former President Bill Clinton, Smokey Robinson and Stevie Wonder. That's the latest. I'm Daisy Gray.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Labour MP for Bristol North West, Darren Jones. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 7 o'clock news, we go to Hong Kong, which is facing a triple whammy human rights onslaught from Beijing against freedom of speech, freedom of the press and the right of assembly. Anyone suggesting Hong Kongers might decide who runs their own city is a subversive. And if you advocate for independence from China, well, that's sedition. We have an exclusive interview for you tonight with Joshua Wong, who's already done 6 months in jail. That was just for being part of the Umbrella Movement back in 2014. He's also the leader of the pro-democracy movement. A quarter of a million people were mobilised, as I said, back in 2014. Also, a decade ago, Libya boasted the best life expectancy and standard of living in a whole of Africa. Now it's mob rule. Many are saying the West is deliberately promoting two rival armed factions to reduce the country to ruin. Who started it all? And who was the godfather, the mobster in chief behind the Iraq war? Everyone seems to be warning at the moment of preparations for a false flag chemical attack in Idlib, apart from the BBC, that is, to be blamed on the Syrians or Russians. We asked Martin Summers about that. Also, Israel's teenage online troll and spy army. It's called Unit 8200. And their government's 2,700 assassinations and counting, as revealed in Ronan Bergman's new book, Rise Up and Kill First, including, we hear this week, Middle Eastern leaders. So how come the Israeli state is so confident our media doesn't report hardly any of Israel's war crimes? And today's tweet from Benjamin Netanyahu, trying to out-potty mouth Trump. He says, the weak crumble, are slaughtered and are erased from history, while the strong, for good or ill, survive. The strong are respected and alliances are made with the strong, and in the end, peace is made with the strong. That's a tweet from Netanyahu today. So, in our series, Getting to Know the Israeli Cabinet, this week, the Defence Minister, Avigdor Lieberman. What's he been saying recently? Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after seven. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, dry. Tomorrow, warm and sunny. That's 22 Celsius. Sunday, a bit cloudier and cooler. Next week, Monday will be wet, but sunny periods for the rest of the week. Next weekend, it's the 8th and 9th of September. More sunny periods, a few showers. And the weekend after next, clearer thereafter. That's into September. So helping us review this week's news is Labour MP for Bristol North West, Darren Jones. Hi, Darren. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, good evening.
Now, you're quite, I suppose it's... I may be a bit patronising to say an expert, but you're quite interested in technology, aren't you? And I believe you're on one of the select committees on technology.
That's right, yeah. I sit on the Science and Technology Select Committee.
So tell us what you sort of things you talk about on this select committee.
Oh, well, on the select committee, we do a whole host of things. Science and Technology has the remit to look at any area of government policy where we want to review academic research and to try to come up with some evidence-based policy recommendations for government, and increasingly where we want to look at kind of technological advancement.
Can you be specific about specific things you're looking at rather than general?
Well, it's important to understand how the committee works because we can look at any area that we want to. I mean, the inquiries that we've been looking at since I've been on the committee have ranged from regulation of decision-making algorithms, looking at the government's biometric...
Hang on. Decision-making algorithms?
Yeah,
what
exactly.
Are they?
So basically, computer software that makes decisions... without human intervention. So that might be a kind of loan decision, or it might be a decision in some police forces about whether you get a knock at the door, for example. And we were looking at the way these kind of fancy computer systems are being used in different settings. So that's one example. We've just done.
How do the police use these algorithms? That's fascinating. And I imagine it's not all forces, just some forces.
No, exactly. It's just some of them. So we were looking at Durham in particular, who use an algorithm to decide things like remand decisions. Other forces like Avon and Somerset use algorithms to try to decide how best to deploy the limited numbers of police officers they have based on where the data suggests crime is more likely to happen. But the things that we then for worry about as policymakers is, well, how do you decide where crime is more likely to happen? Do you hard code biases, for example? And how do you have oversight of that in public services? So that was one example of something we've looked at.
Well, that's fascinating. Is it happening? Are computers making these decisions now?
Yes, there they are. They are, and they're making increasingly sophisticated decisions. The law that we just passed, which is something that I worked on in what's called the Bill Committee, says that it must have a human intervention. So there must be a human decision at the end of it. Otherwise, you have a right not to be subjected to that automated decision. The challenge, of course, is that some users will say, well, if a human's looking at the computer and agree or not agreeing with the decision, then that's a human intervention. But as we know, ultimately, you probably just do what the computer says. So we need to think about how we update our laws to work for those types of things.
This is sounding a bit like the technocracy coming in, where yeah. People who control the technology control you, actually. I'm not talking about us. I'm talking about the MPs.
Well, to a certain extent, yeah. And it's an interesting question in terms of class politics as well, because, you know, if it's the people that own the technology companies and the data that will have increasing power in our economies. And, you know, we've seen the Cambridge Analytica scandals. One of the workers have been prosecuted in the United States today for their involvement in the Mueller, in the US investigation that Mueller's doing. And we need to start having some Labour Party answers to this around the empowerment of workers and citizens and people who own their data, but where companies are in essence owning it on their behalf, perhaps without permission these days.
I mean, okay, so this policing and algorithms is one thing. I mean, what can parliamentarians do about this? Because a lot of the time it seems to me that the technology is running way ahead of the legislators.
Yeah, so legislation's really slow and it's not that pretty when you make it. It's a bit like a sausage factory, really, when you become a legislator. And the fact is, it's a global issue as well. So, you know, we can set laws in the UK and we do that, and we're pretty good compared to other countries. But the best way to do it is to work internationally. Nationally, that's one example as to why I'd rather we were staying in the European Union. But it's not just about Europe. It's increasingly about China and about the United States as well. And we need to be doing more work globally on trying to get this right, especially as we move into areas of things like artificial intelligence and robotics.
Does artificial intelligence really exist? I mean, how close are we to that? I think they call it the singularity, don't they, where the idea is that the computer will actually be able to make decisions better than a human.
Yeah, so well, there's the concept of general artificial intelligence where you get to that kind of somewhat Hollywood-style position. We're not there yet, for sure, but you know, the application of computers making decisions in a way that humans currently can't, and the computing power that comes with that, often off the back of big data, is a reality today, and it will be an increasing reality in the years ahead. So it's something that we need to keep an eye on in terms of how that's used in our day-to-day lives and what that means for protection of you know, traditional civil rights in a modern setting.
How can you do that, though? It's almost impossible, isn't it? If a computer makes the wrong decision, how do you then legislate for that?
Well, the legislation is about the protections around using the computer in the first place. I'm not someone that says you should legislate to stop it because you'll hamper a lot of innovation as a consequence. But we do need to understand how these things work and what the impacts are.
What about making people aware that a decision, say, for example, I don't know, about their benefits or something, which may be a life-changing decision, are made by a computer? Are people allowed to know?
Yeah, they are, and they're allowed to know today under new European data protection laws. But the challenge is that some of these algorithms are getting so complicated now that even though the law says you have a right to call up and ask why this decision was made about you, the reality is if you call a customer service number, they're not going to be able to tell you why the algorithm made a decision. So the new laws we've just put in place are already too old, and that's why I and others spend a bit of time trying to keep this on the agenda.
Now, I noticed this is a couple of months ago, actually. When was it? No, well, 6 months ago, actually, more than that, 6th of December. Bristol wants to be the first city to use electronic voting to elect its politicians. Darren Jones, that's you, is leading the charge for e-voting in the city, and the city council backs the move. How's that all going?
Not very well. I mean, the point behind all of that is that I want to increase democratic engagement, especially amongst young people. And e-voting is something that I've been interested in, but the providers of e-voting equipment haven't really shone themselves in any glory in the United States. Although they've done a bit better in other places like Estonia. And I wanted just to trial it to see whether actually it increased democratic engagement in the first place, perhaps in a councillor election alongside traditional voting methods, to see what if it worked. But it's difficult to do that. Actually,
now, I don't know if you know, there's a website called Black Box Voting. At least, I don't know if it's still there. I was looking at this probably 18 months ago, and they had a video of how to move the votes around from behind the scenes. So, you know, here you go onto this page here, you enter this password into this bit of software, and then you pick up a whole bunch of votes from one candidate and drop them in to another candidate. Now, I mean, it does seem as if the checks and balances are not necessarily there in the same way as they are with paper voting, Darren. I mean, I this makes me a bit nervous. It's one of the things that the Americans have embraced, and look where it's got them.
Well, sure. And I'm not saying that, you know, it works today in the way that it needs to. I'm saying we need to keep it on the agenda. And certainly what I wasn't proposing was stopping being able to vote by, you know, paper and pencil. But if this is a way we can innovate to increase people getting involved in democracy, then that's a good thing. But we do have to get it right, and we need the protections in place.
Okay. What about hacking? We've been hearing this week about North Korea, Iran and Russia hacking everything. Where do you stand on this? Is it really one-sided, or are we just as good as they are at it?
I think we're probably just as good as they are at it. But we, in terms of our military spend, we don't spend as much in that so-called sixth domain of warfare. I think it's the sixth, maybe the fifth, I've lost count, but whichever one it is.
They'll tell you at Sandhurst, I'm sure they know.
Well, I've not been there, so that's probably why I don't know the answer. So we don't invest as much as other countries in this, because obviously we invest a lot in traditional military power. But there's no denying that hacking is a modern type of warfare, whether it's nation state or otherwise, and you know, as more and more of our infrastructure becomes online and our lives become online, that's an increased risk, and we need to make sure that we're properly protected.
Well, it certainly is, because the Americans have said, well, we reserve the right, if we're a victim of a cyber attack by Putin, we reserve the right to retaliate with nuclear weapons. So we've really got to make sure we know who's doing the hacking, haven't we? Is there any way to know?
Yes, there is. You can know. I mean, there's lots of sophisticated techniques where you use different types of virtual networks to redirect the location, makes it hard to know where it's coming from. But, you know, our intelligence services are pretty confident that they know when there are major cyber attacks happening, where they're coming from. And because it's turned into this domain of warfare, in the same way as with others, you know, countries want the right to retaliate. I mean, with President Trump in office, the idea of a nuclear retaliation to a cyber attack fills me somewhat with dread, but it's right that it needs to be included in our defence strategies.
Well, look, our own side aren't squeaky clean either, are they? We've got MI5 agents, this is back in March this year, can commit crime in the UK, the government reveals. A secret order on authorised criminality by spies was made public after a legal battle by various rights groups, MI5 agents are allowed to carry out criminal activity in the UK if they like. The government's acknowledged for the first time the Prime Minister on Thursday was forced to publish the text of a direction to the Investigatory Powers Commission's office spying watchdog on governing security service participation in criminality. Now, you know, I'm a little bit reluctant to trust the Secret Services, whether it be the signals intelligence people, whether it's MI5, MI6, when they are allowed to get away with things like this, because what they're effectively saying there is they're above the law.
Well, I don't know the detail behind that story, so I can't comment on that in particular. But what I do know is that the threats the country faces are real, and we need to ensure that we have people able to do their jobs. My hope would be that that could be done within a strong legal framework where people are accountable, as opposed to the suggestions that you've just made. But as I say, I've not seen that story, so I don't know the background to that.
Martin Summers, what do you make of this? The Secret Services on this side, we're hearing a lot about the sort of cyber hacking, these kinds of things from the Iranians, the Russians, etc. Chinese as well. They're pretty good at it, apparently, but very little about our own side, really.
Well, we've got our own Brigade 77, which has over 1,000 personnel, all of which are officers, so it must cost quite a lot. They'll all be at least $30,000 apiece. And they are just cyber warfare. They just sit there all day pretending to be people they're not, trying to influence events. And I think
that's not quite the same as hacking, is it?
Well, no, the GCHQ has already admitted that they engage in hacking and distributed denial attacks on targets. So we know, in actual fact, that the intelligence services have engaged in this sort of thing for quite a long time.
Well, one of the places nearby where this hacking is supposed to go on is in between Bath and Chippenham, and it's a great big maze of underground caverns. Actually, you can go down there if you're into caving. And I did this, gosh, must be 10 years ago with a couple of friends. And after an hour of going through these caves in me welly boots and with a torch and a packed lunch, which we had down in this dark in the middle of nowhere under these caves, you come across this, what I can only describe as something, it looks like a sort of blast door. Right down in the middle of the mountain, and you can hear sort of whirring generators the other side of it. Anyway, it's quite weird and creepy. But anyway, one person, I mean, the thing is, you can't really ask the Ministry of Defence what goes on there, because you can be almost certain they're going to tell you some cock and bull story. But one person you can ask is investigative journalist Matthew Williams from Devizes, who's been down there recently. He goes down a lot of these places, and he's also started filming a lot of these places from the air, where you're allowed to, with a drone. So I asked him about this new GCHQ Centre for Hacking, which is being installed in Corsham. And this actually is going to be on the full interview on Dialect next Tuesday at noon. But we'll have a little listen to a short excerpt now.
Redlaw Manor comprises a number of bases. There's Basil Hill Barracks, there's the newly created GCHQ, which is a story in itself, known as the GOSCC. They call it the GOSC. So if you ring them up and say, can I be put through to GOSC, please? They'll know exactly what you mean. But it's GOSCC, which is a Global Operations Security Command Centre, I think it is. And this is an offshoot of GCHQ. Recently, they were looking to employ hackers. They actually put this in the local press. Are you a hacker? Would you like to be a hacker for the Ministry of Defence? And, you know, I thought hacking was illegal. But it's okay when you've got a government hat on it. You know, it's okay to hack.
Well, you've got crown immunity, haven't you?
Well, that's right, yes. But, I mean, of course, they play these games by saying, oh, we don't hack people in the UK because that would be illegal. You know, so what we do is we ask the Americans to hack for us in the UK, so they hack us and we will hack for them, so that we don't break each other's laws under this UK-US agreement of 1950, I think it is, yes. Well, I think it's about $750 million has got spent, which is money which was given to GCHQ, and then GCHQ say, we've spent it now, but suddenly you see that a figure of $750 million has been spent in Corsham, and buildings appear, and data centres, which are privately owned, which is interesting, of course, front companies for the MOD to make it look like, you know, it's not the MOD operating these things anymore. And surprisingly, for a front company, they did a very silly thing and put Elizabeth Mannington Buller, the ex-head of MI5, is one of the company directors.
Actress Manningham Buller, who used to be known as Bullying Manor, apparently, when she was Director General of MI5. I'm joined by Darren Jones, Bristol North West Labour MP. Now, this Matthew, I think you have to take some of what he says with a pinch of salt, because it's difficult to know what is going on. They make it as difficult as possible for everyone to find out, even the locals, and sometimes even people that work there. They give them cover stories so that they'll tell people outside something completely wrong. But what the most concerning thing about all of that is this privatisation business. I mean, if we're going into the realms of signals intelligence and privatising it, that concerns me. I wonder what you make of does that make any sense to privatise something like that?
I don't know who those companies are or what the defence strategy is, in the same way that that you don't. My general view on that is that I would rather it was kept within the auspices of the Ministry of Defence, in the same way as I'd rather other public services remained within the auspices of the state. Not least because we've seen in the past where some private companies have caused some national security concerns based on who ultimately owns those private companies. And the UK was the first country, for example, to require the Chinese telecoms company Huawei to have clearance via GCHQ before it introduced technology infrastructure into the UK. But Huawei has just been banned from Australia, for example, because of concerns around Chinese state interference and the access that comes as a consequence of their technology. So you do need to go quite careful. I mean, there's Russian examples as well of some of these technology companies where ultimately there's a backdoor for nation state surveillance.
Well, I say to them is Bill Gates. I mean, he's been doing it for decades, hasn't he? But anyway, look, let's talk about some of the more sort of down to earth stuff. Housing the homeless, feeding the hungry, and educating kids. Yeah. That's proving rather difficult since 2010 and the austerity program. Darren, what do you intend to do about it if Labour gets into power?
Well, the good thing is that if Labour gets into power, we're going to rebalance our tax and spend priorities, so we've got some actual money to be able to redistribute and to invest into some of these priority areas for us. The mayor here, Marvin Rees, is doing his best to build as many houses and affordable houses and council houses as possible. This week we've just set up our new housing company in the council to try to speed that up, but the fact of the matter is the purse strings are still controlled by Westminster, and there's still cuts to funding to local services, and that's why we've seen such an increase in homelessness in Bristol, such an increase in the use of food banks, such an increase in families not being able to make ends meet.
Where is Labour going to get the money from?
Well, I mean, it's about the levels of corporation tax primarily is the basis. But
the companies will leave, won't they? They'll just leave Britain. They'll go somewhere else.
No, I don't think that's true. I mean, there's lots of companies who make a lot of money from British consumers. They're not just going to leave a consumer market of 65 million people with quite a lot of wealth. I mean, that doesn't make sense. I think they're more likely to move headquarters or whatever as a consequence of Brexit as opposed to sensible corporation tax. Fact of the matter is the Tories have cut corporation tax consistently since 2010, even though we were the lowest in the G7 at that point in terms of corporation tax. So that's why we've said we want to put that back up to the level it was when we left government. And that would raise, I think it was estimated, around £45-50 billion of extra spending.
What about privatising the railways? Strike after strike, loads of cancellations. These companies that have got the franchises don't even employ enough drivers to drive the trains that are scheduled.
Yep. So the railways aren't working, both in terms of the way in which services be delivered, but also in terms of the pricing of people's tickets, where it's linked to inflation, and there's been enormous increases, even though wages haven't been increasing. That's why the Labour policy is to renationalise the railway, so that we can make that a system that works for commuters and not for shareholders' profit.
Okay, getting back to the technology stuff, Julian Assange,
He's
an interesting character, isn't he? Some love him, some hate him, but there's very few in between. Where do you stand? Because he's now been cut off from the internet as of something like 2 or 3 months ago. He's not allowed to do what he used to do, which was to be one of the world's either most wicked or most radical publishers, depending on which side of the line you're on.
I'm not sure where I fall on Julian Assange. I mean, he uncovered some stuff which was really important to uncover, but in doing so also, I think, caused probably quite a lot of harm as a consequence, and continues to be in a position where...
Okay, what harm has he caused?
Well, I just think in terms of there was exposure of individuals and processes from government that perhaps wouldn't be helpful in terms of some of the work that they do internationally. And ultimately, I think Julian is...
Well, I'm going to try and pin you down a bit more on that. That's a very flaky answer. What has he actually done which is compromised governments, because the thing is, we do need people to be looking at governments and sometimes be asking embarrassing questions, revealing embarrassing facts.
Yeah, so it's right to say government should be accountable, but I don't think you make governments accountable by open sourcing everything, which is essentially what he was seeking to do. I think ultimately Julian is probably a bit of an anarchist, which I disagree with as a Democrat, so that's why I feel a bit uncomfortable about it.
Martin?
Well, I think the fact is, has he done anything illegal? And the answer is no, he hasn't, in fact. All he's done is leak stuff that was sent to him. And, of course, what's very important is the stuff they leaked about the US election, which is about the rigging of the Democratic primaries, which everybody accepts that's what the emails show. And all the row about Russiagate has been whether the Russians hacked it out or not. In actual fact, they Julian Assange and Craig Murray both say that they didn't hack it out, that they were given it, and it wasn't a leak. It was a leak, not a hack. And that sort of information, I mean, some people in the States are asking for him to go over and testify about this to the Senate in return for a prosecution deal. But of course, the prosecution is treason against the United States, but he's a citizen of Australia and he's in Britain, so it doesn't really stand up to much scrutiny.
What about this anti-Semitism row this week? I mean, it's not just this week, is it, Darren? What is going on? Is Jeremy Corbyn a hater of Jews or not?
The issue we have is that there's this internationally recognised definition of what anti-Semitism means.
But it's not internationally recognised all over the world by everybody, is it? It's a international definition that some people choose to use and others don't.
Well, it's adopted by the mainstream, including government in this country. And essentially, the Labour Party has decided to only apply half of it and not the other half. That's something that I regret. I think it's been the basis of a lot of these complaints. And Jeremy's views, whether they've been historic or otherwise, have kind of inflamed some of the media reporting around this over the summer. My ask has always been, I think we should just adopt the definition and then seek to apply that in the fair way using the rule book and the Labour Party.
I mean, some Jews do compare Israel to the Nazis, and that makes them anti-Semitic?
Well, look, it's not for me to go through a whole set of hypothetical circumstances. The fact is, this is a definition that's been widely adopted. If we should be preparing and acting like a party ready to be in government. We are not saying, and I sincerely hope we're not saying, that one of our priorities, if we were to be elected next week in government, would be to change the definition of anti-Semitism that the government is currently signed up to. I mean, it just shouldn't be on the agenda, which is why I think we need to adopt the full definition and move on.
Do you agree with Jonathan Sachs when he says that Jeremy Corbyn is the worst racist since Enoch Powell?
I probably wouldn't use those words, but I think it's fair to say that some of the comments largely...
How racist is he?
Well, I don't know Jeremy particularly well, so all I can base it on is the evidence of videos and comments that I've seen largely through reporting over the summer, many of which, is from my perspective, have gone too far. There has been some kind of inflation reporting in the media too, but essentially some of Jeremy's views have been unacceptable. I think he should apologise for those. I think he should adopt the definition and then make sure that it's applied properly in the Labour Party.
Is it okay to say that Zionists don't have as good a sense of humour as other people? Is that an anti-Semitic thing to say?
Again, I'm not going to be a judge and arbiter on the application of these definitions to your hypothetical scenarios. I think we need to adopt the rule and apply it in the right way.
What about those that say that the definition you're talking about is designed to stop criticism, not of Jews, but of the Israeli state?
Well, that's just incorrect. I mean, it's absolutely incorrect. We have Jewish members of parliament who have been lobbying for the full definition to be applied, who also openly criticise Benjamin Netanyahu. And of course, because he's a right-wing, hardman politician, you know, that we on the left criticise. It's perfectly okay to do that under the definition.
Let's have a listen now to Theresa May, who she had a few things to say about Labour and anti-Semitism this week too.
Anti-Semitism is racism, and we should all condemn racism in all its forms. Obviously, Lord Sacks was a long-standing chief rabbi. He has raised significant concerns, but it's not only him. Members of the Labour Party have raised concerns as well. I think the leader of the Labour Party needs to respond to those concerns.
Concerns, she was saying at the end there. Martin Summers, it sounds like Theresa May is weighing in with people like Jonathan Sachs saying that Jeremy Corbyn is not up to the job.
Well, she would, wouldn't she? It's her job to do that, if you like, just as it's Jeremy Corbyn's job to try and undermine her. And she's just making, you know, she's just making political capital out of the situation.
What about Frank Field then, Darren? Because he's resigned the Labour whip. He's now, we've just heard on the news, going to be told that unless he takes the Labour whip back in 2 weeks' time, he'll be expelled from the party.
I just think it's a great shame when Labour MPs feel that they have to take action like that, especially Labour MPs who have been MPs for quite so long, but also members for even longer. Now, I have some kind of fundamental disagreements with Frank on policy, Brexit being one of them, but there is no denying the fact that he's been a champion for the working classes longer than I've been alive. And I just think it's a sad day when you end up having a colleague like that deciding to leave. And it's also sad when people are quite so critical of him without really kind of paying him the respect for his contribution.
Related to this, I mean, it's one of the, it's just, I suppose, a similar thing about whether it's scapegoating or not is for anyone to decide. But it does look as if it's a similar situation for Alex Salmond this week, the former SNP leader. He's resigned from the SNP over allegations of sexual misconduct. The thing that's most shocking really about this is not necessarily those allegations, Darren. It's that the Scottish Parliament actually leaked them to the press. There was an investigation, internal investigation going on, and these allegations then got made widely available to the public and then have caused the former leader of the SNP to resign. I mean, this doesn't sound to me like the Scottish Parliament really doing their job.
No, and you know, proper processes and procedures ought to be followed, not least because in the past, you know, allegations have been proven not to be true, and there needs to be a fair process that's followed. But ultimately, if he has been sexually harassing people and that's been proven to be the case, then he needs to be accountable for that.
Finally, I'll let you go in a minute because you've got to go, I know, early today. What's your take on vaccines? Because we've seen a lot of controversy over the last few years about vaccines. I'm not sure if you're in any way an expert on the pharmaceutical industry. But there is, I mean, for example, there was an article in the Daily Mail earlier this year quoting research that links autism to aluminium, which is used as a preservative in some vaccines. So, I mean, it just seems to me that anybody that says that vaccines may not be safe, they're almost like a vaccine denier. And there isn't really a proper debate going on over this. I mean, I'd love to see the BBC do one of their good old-fashioned documentaries where they get all extreme points of view and present all the evidence, but we're not really getting that. Where do you stand on something like that? Would you, for example, have your kids vaccinated?
Yes.
An MMR vaccine?
Yes, without question, because I know that the systems in this country are extremely rigorous in ensuring that when vaccines come to the market, they do so in the safest possible way. Quite frankly, it's, you know, there is a risk to getting out of bed in the morning. I could be run over by a bus. It doesn't mean I don't get out of bed. In the same way, we know that vaccines are a really, really important part of our public health policy. And I think any stories that inflame the prospect of parents choosing not to vaccinate their children is a real shame. And it should be based on evidence. And this is an area that we also look at on the Science and Technology Select Committee, which is why I have confidence that the regulatory schemes in place work well.
Well, I'm afraid the Daily Mail also has evidence. They say perhaps we now have the link between vaccination and autism. The professor is revealing aluminium in jabs may cause sufferers to have up to 10 times more of the metal in their brains than is safe. Now, we know that this metal is also linked to Alzheimer's. And you sure that you've done enough research to know that these are safe? Because remember, the pharmaceutical industry has an enormous incentive on making these, you know, public, the people like you saying that this is a safe vaccine to use.
Yeah, but again, this is nonsense. I mean, you know, there's one study with inferences based on what we know about a particular metal-based product is not the same as peer-reviewed, proper, longitudinal, qualitative research, which has been put through and tested properly, which is the basis, alongside clinical trials, for all of our vaccinations. And again, I just think these stories are very, very dangerous.
Where are you running off to now then, Darren?
I have a pub politics event in my constituency at 7 o'clock, which is one of the ways in which I engage with my constituents in an informal and enjoyable setting.
So how often do you do that and where is it?
So I do coffee mornings once a month, pub politics once a month, and I also had picnic politics this afternoon at Blaise Castle, which is very nice. And today I'm at the Eastville Inn in Henleys.
Okay, picnic politics. What, you sort of sit around and have sandwiches and...
We had biscuits and
cucumber,
squash.
Cucumber sandwiches?
Biscuits and squash, and that was about the extent of it, sadly. But,
all right.
Yeah.
Darren Jones, Labour MP for Bristol North West, thanks very much for joining us here on The Politics Show. And while you're getting out of the studio, we'll hear from Roger Waters, who also had some pretty strong words for... He's the singer of Pink Floyd. Some pretty strong words about the... for start, social media, and secondly, about the Russian channel RT.
Facebook and Google and YouTube and whatever are the way that most people get their news, and they use that social media in order to educate themselves or find out what's going on. But the content is being censored by the corporations that own it. So it won't be free. I mean, it's not free now. And they are targeting... I wouldn't be surprised if I disappear because I'm anti-war. When I was making this record I just made, This Is the Life We Really Want, the guy who was producing this record with me started telling me about RT, how RT was just pure propaganda, nothing but a pack of lies. Well, I watch RT. You can't see a documentary about fracking on American television because they're not interested in telling you anything about anything.
That's a bit of an exaggeration. Well, no, actually, in a way, it's not, is it, Martin? The US and Britain, the broadcasters are not interested in telling us about fracking, and I wonder why that is.
Well, because, as you're probably aware, there are vested interests behind what goes out in the West. I mean, I'm fairly regular on RT, as you know, Tony, and in actual fact, if you compare it to something like Fox News, it's a completely different level of debate. And of course the Daily Mail, which you were quoting earlier, frequently comes out with what are essentially fake news stories and has done for donkey's years. RT, like everybody else, is
every newspaper does that.
Well, no, everybody's got their point of view, but I think what RT is trying to do, it's actually rather highbrow. They try to get experts on there who talk in a fairly high level about what's going on.
I don't agree. I think sometimes they just get people on who don't seem to hardly even know what they're talking about, and they babble on for a few minutes and then off they go.
Well, I mean, but what they do is they allow everybody to have their say. And of course,
they don't allow the anti-Putin people.
Well,
to
have their say. Everybody has got their point of view, and the Russia Today, funded by the Russian
government.
Everybody's
got their sacred cow.
Well, indeed. And the fact is, if you watch, you shouldn't just watch one lot of stuff. You should watch everybody's stuff. And I usually get my information from the internet, and I read everybody's stuff. And you can usually tell, but if you compare who's lying and who isn't lying. And I think what RT has done, which the West hates, is that they come up with stuff on international affairs which goes against the grain of the Western consensus.
Well, what
and
Roger
of course
Waters
they're actually able to communicate it to a large audience.
What
as well.
Roger Waters is talking about there is his producer Nigel Godrich, who's also the producer of Radiohead. And it is a bit worrying, isn't it, when someone who's a sort of top person in the music industry, producers, actually, I suppose I'm a producer-presenter, there seems to be a sort of concentration of anti-Russian, pro-Western, a particular mindset of producers that are all in the same kind of groupthink.
Well, what happens is effectively groupthink. If you are part of the mainstream within the Overton window, as they call it, of mainstream thinking in the West, then of course it's more than your career's worth to start coming out with stuff which other people don't agree with.
You come out with something different, and something might happen to your career.
Well, everybody knows that, and they don't even have to be told. Yeah. Everybody knows when you go into a new workplace, anybody listening to this will know this, you work out what's going on, who you mustn't cross, the sort of things you mustn't say, and you don't even have to be told, you work it out. If you want to climb the greasy pole, you've got to know these things. And I'm afraid that's how it works. And no doubt it works similarly in RT as in any other organisation. But if you compare RT, for example, to the Tory press in this country, the Tory press doesn't really come across very well. And there's no competition, frankly.
Also, from a general point of view, we seem to be... do you have any idea the amount of quantitative easing that's going on at the moment? Because it's we heard last week from Manfred, didn't we? Manfred Petrisch in the second hour about the dead patient, the coma patient that's being kept alive. Mm. You use similar analogies sometimes. The amount must be in the hundreds of billions a year. Mm. That's being injected into the economy. What do you make of Is it feasible to divert some of that money into ordinary people's pockets, even like the Icelandic people have done, into the pockets of the unemployed?
Well, they could always have decided to reflate the economy from the bottom up, but they didn't choose to do that. They chose to prop up the existing infrastructure of the financial services industry. But what's actually happening now, which is more interesting than quantitative easing, is quantitative tightening in the US. They're not able to do that in Europe. Don't forget, as you've got from Manfred Petris last week, the European Central Bank is not supposed to quantitatively ease at all. It's actually against its constitution, and the German government was at first completely opposed to the idea, but now they've been sold on it because the alternative to quantitative easing is a collapse of the German banking system. And of course, when they were faced with that shotgun in the face, they decided quantitative easing could happen. So quantitative easing is still happening in Europe, partly because of the problems in Italy, partly because of the problems now in Turkey, which affects the Spanish banks in particular. But quantitative tightening is what's going on in the US, and that means, of course, that all the money that flooded, all the easy money that flooded into the emerging markets like Turkey and Brazil and Argentina and Indonesia, is now all flooding back into the US, which is pushing up the US stock market, but it's crashing these other countries. Now, of course, they will eventually be placed into a default position, and when they default, they will drag down the US banking system and the European banking system. Nobody gets out alive, and the situation is actually quite dire. Of course, we've got used to it over 10 years, and imagine that it's just going to carry on as it is, but it isn't.
It's not just 10 years, is it? It's 40 or 50 years. It's slowly been getting worse.
Well, the quantitative easing is 10 years.
It's slowly been getting worse.
Yeah, but we've got used to it.
A longer period of time. And I'm thinking about Yanis Varoufakis quite a lot, because we've had him on the last couple of weeks, and everything he says seems to make a lot of sense. Maybe we should do this, Martin? Maybe have a campaign to have Yanis Varoufakis on this programme every week until he's made Chancellor.
Well, I'm always happy to hear what he's got to say. That's all I'll say on that point.
Do you think has he got any major flaws in his analysis, do you think?
You have to read between the lines to see. I mean, there's nuance there. You have to listen carefully, because he's always got something interesting to say.
Well, here he is now talking about something called the Volcker Study, which happened back in the late 1960s, early 70s, before Henry Kissinger was Secretary of State over in the United States.
What did the Americans do when they realized that they have a deficit situation now, which was actually growing? They did something absolutely astonishingly remarkable. They decided that the solution to the deficit problem is to enhance their deficits, to make them grow, and to make them grow at an increasing rate. Now, that is an astonishing conception. And how am I backing up this story? Well, Paul Volcker was a young man who worked for Henry Kissinger, before Henry Kissinger became Secretary of State for the United States, when he was still National Security Advisor. And Volcker was working for him, and Kissinger asked Volcker, who is a young banker, to come up with an idea as to how could American hegemony be expanded when the deficit is increasing. And Volcker wrote a 3-page report, which actually I've read. It was very difficult to get, and you cannot find it anywhere, even on the internet. I have it in a manuscript form that was given to me by a friend in America some time ago, which is perhaps the most remarkable statement of the 20th century. Oh, well, I'm exaggerating, but you know what I mean. In it he said, well, if we can't remain hegemonic, that's the word he used. Huh? No, that's not a left-wing text, it's Volcker. If we can't remain hegemonic by handling, was the word he used, our surpluses, we should do it by handling other people's surpluses. And that's the global minimum. Effectively, what America did was to say, okay, well, we don't have a surplus anymore, so we can't recycle it, but we can recycle everybody else's surpluses and retain our hegemonical position through that. And this is the very first time in human economic history, or history in general, that an empire is expanding its realm and its power and its strength and vitality by expanding its deficits. Usually, when an empire enters into deficit, it's the beginning of its decline. Not in the case of the United States. So, this is the story of the book. How did they conceptualize, and how did they implement, and how did they effect so successfully for so long, between the early 1970s and 2008, a policy of enhancing their hegemony, of creating a very dynamic global capitalism with enormous imbalances, inequities, and human tragedies, by expanding their deficits and having other people paying for them. Because that's what recycling other people's surpluses means.
Well, that's very much to the point, isn't it? When Nixon took the dollar off gold in 1971, he's basically saying that we're not going to play by the rules everybody else plays by. We can run deficits, but nobody else can. And, of course, the Reagan era in the United States was the era of the massive expansion of the US trade deficit and the US budget deficit. And, of course, because they're the United States and everybody has to buy their oil in dollars because of the deal done with the Saudis but in the 1970s by Kissinger, everybody has to have dollars. Even though, in actual fact, if the US was a normal country, everybody would be selling dollars because the country's bankrupt. They're not bankrupt because they then use the resources that get sucked into the stock market in the US. They use that to fund their military, which then puts a gun to everybody's head and makes the whole situation carry on. And the only thing that stops it is when the market itself cracks, because there really isn't any more juice to be extracted. Well, this is what happened in 2008.
One of the books Yanis Varoufakis published, not sure when exactly, 1990s, mid-1990s, was about game theory. He did it jointly with somebody else. Now, isn't that really what's going on here? The bankers are just playing a game with us?
Well, that's right. See, the conventional economic textbooks presume what they're supposed to prove, which is free international competition and free competition within national markets. Now, in actual fact, if you know anything about economic history, that's just not the case. Britain didn't become wealthy by having a free market. It became wealthy by having a Royal Navy, which enforced, to begin with, a slave trade. And then when we'd made money out of the slave trade, it then enforced other people not to have one. And the Royal Navy was the key, not the free market. And of course, that just goes to show. And of course, that before the modern welfare state, the military was by far the biggest expenditure of any state. It still uses up half of US tax expenditures, and the idea of a free market is basically a myth for kiddies. Adults know that it doesn't work like that.
Didn't the Royal Navy used to, if a country owned Britain money, what the Royal Navy would do is sort of chug up to one of their port cities, point all their guns at the port and say, unless you pay up, we're going to start firing.
Well, that's what happened with about the Suez, the Egyptians and the Suez Canal in 1956, but the Egyptians were just, because things had changed, we didn't get away with it like we used to do, and that was the end of that for now. But of course, we've since invaded Iraq and Afghanistan, and we're back to our old tricks, aren't we?
Talking of owing people money, Wonga has just gone bust today, hasn't it? It's gone into administration, although British customers are being told that you will still have to be required to pay any outstanding money.
Well, that's presumably because the creditors of Wonga will want their pound of flesh. Now, in actual fact, anybody who lent Wonga money, I would argue that when it goes bankrupt, you've got to lose it, but they will have creditors. And, of course, the people they've lent money to are the debit. You know, they are the ones who are going to have to pay. And, of course, whoever takes over this debt, you know, it's like selling a debt on, you know, when the local council sells a housing benefit overpayment to a private debt collector, they go in and try and get the money off them. And I imagine this is actually not good news for people who've borrowed money from Wonga, because the people will want their money back that lost their money in Wonga, and they're going to want it back from their skin.
But people, I mean, the reason that Wonga have gone bust is because people can't pay.
Well, that's right. The business model has collapsed because ultimately people cannot pay. I mean, it's inevitable, isn't it, if you think about it? The kind of interest rates Wonga are charging, when people borrow from Wonga to pay for the Christmas for their kids, they're not thinking about January, and Wonga were quite happy to make money doing that. But ultimately, of course, as a business model, it's a non-starter. It's similar to what's happened with the flooding the world with dollars, with quantitative easing, and then you raise the interest rate and suddenly Turkey can't pay, Argentina can't pay, Brazil can't pay, and then when they collapse, they pull down the banks who lent them the money in the first place, because everything's connected to everything else.
House of Fraser nearly went bust the other week, but Amazon's doing really well. They hardly pay any tax.
Well, Amazon is basically a shadow. It's a shadow organisation, like all of these. But you know, I was looking at something earlier. The only things propping up the US stock market are the big tech companies like Amazon, Facebook, and so on. All the others are actually in the doldrums, and the stock market has now reached the height of euphoria. And of course, everybody's saying, "Well, now the only way is up." And of course, that's what Trump was saying before he was elected, that it was a bubble and it was bound to collapse. Now that he's decided that he's into this. This way of doing things, he's expanded the budget deficit, which will of course expand the trade deficit's increasing as well.
Martin, he's also looking in the mirror saying, aren't I doing well?
Well, that's right, because in other words, like, as you know, Trump's fairly, you know, he's a shallow, two-faced person, and he's got no real bottom to him, and he suddenly realised that he can, in the short run, goose the economy by increasing the budget deficit. So he's cut taxes, increased military spending, and he's also decided, and of course the trade deficit has increased. That's why they've got a trade deficit. It's because they're running a budget deficit. If they balance the books, they could probably get a balanced trade situation with the rest of the world. And the more they unbalance the books, the worse the trade deficit gets for them. Yeah. It's exactly what Varoufakis was saying earlier. But ultimately, this cracks because the market. I'm a socialist, but I recognise how markets work. Ultimately, people realise it's a scam and they all run for the exits. And at that point, it all collapses. So and we're pretty close to that point.
Are our politicians, Theresa May, Philip Hammond, are they actually grappling with the economy? Do they know what they're doing in this whole whole pre-Brexit situation? Because I had a look around to see if I could see any discussion about anything to do with money and taxes and anything like that, and all I could find was May risks further rift with Hammond as she announces plastic bag charge is to double.
Well, I think that Hammond, much as I dislike the guy, has got a better idea of what works and what doesn't work than others. But of course,
why is he still doing this QE? And why is he?
Well, he's still doing QE, Tony, because if he didn't, the economy would go down the drain. And when we stop, it will go down the drain.
Why can't he, for example, spend QE on poorer people who could then help get the economy going? It's a no-brainer. And help get them into work.
Because
for
he's
example.
A Tory chancellor and he serves the City of London. It's as simple as that. And maybe we need John McDonnell there to do exactly what you've suggested, and that's what it'll take. And of course, if we, you know, ultimately that's probably what's going to happen.
Looking at Brexit, banks are preparing for house prices to fall by a third after Brexit, says the Metro. Now, that's a lot of money, isn't it? So that would wipe, on the average house price now is, what is it, £300,000-£400,000, something ridiculous like that. That means that everybody that's got one of those houses is going to lose something like £100,000, just like that.
Yeah, and that may be an underestimate, Tony, because if you've got a global financial crisis created by the forces that Varoufakis mentioned earlier...
Well, we've still
got
a tremendous demand for housing, haven't we?
Well, yes, but it's got to be effective demand, Tony. People need houses, but can they pay for them? And the answer is no, they can't. And, of course, the house price crash brings it all down, but then everybody loses their job, so they can't pay the lower prices. And that's a downward spiral unless the government steps in and supports the ordinary people to prevent them falling down the drain, which is what eventually happened in Russia when Putin came to power after years of stagnation and collapse. And that's other places around the world are going to have to face up to it.
I mean, why don't governments cut your way out of recession. Why don't governments support ordinary people anymore? I mean, it just seems
because they never did, Tony.
They have done in the past.
What happened after World War II? Yeah. There was a kind of consensus between the financial services sector and the rest of society, and they were basically there's a technical term for it, it was called financial repression.
They didn't have a choice.
No, that's right. There used to be fixed exchange rates, for example, and you couldn't leave Britain with more than £1,000 without permission from the government,
and that was normal.
That was normal. Now, of course, what's happened is that we had a very successful run from 1945 until the late 70s because the financial services sector was put in the box and kept in the box. But eventually, of course, they just didn't like it. They kicked over the traces, and eventually they were with the big bang in the city, and a very important part of this because that made the city the most important, more important than Wall Street. They were able to throw over these traces and set off this house price bubble and all these other bubbles, because it's not just a house price bubble, there's a bubble in everything. And of course, at some point they come to the end of the line, that crashes, then you get a big system reset. And now we could call it World War III, if you like, because that's what it will be. And we'll either all die of it or we'll all get over it. But, of course, it should never have happened. A more rational policy would have prevented it. But, of course, that
Thatcher Reagan era created all of the problems we're facing now in the financial services sector, the creation of Al-Qaeda, and the privatisation of industries that should never have been privatised. But of course, we did it all, and now we're facing the consequences.
The UK could run out of food a year from now with no deal Brexit, says the National Farmers Union and The Guardian. The Farmers Union says supplies would only last until August next year if Britain had to be self-sufficient. Well, this is a bit of a slightly cheeky headline from The Guardian, because they're implying that we won't be able to import any food, which is, you know, it's not going to happen.
No, I think most likely thing is that the price of food in Britain will rise dramatically as people's incomes are falling. And of course, that will affect the poorest, most, you know, they'll be the ones, well, the ones going to food banks will be the ones who will feel it. And those who are not yet in food banks will be.
Well, it'll be good for farmers.
Well, no, not in the long run, Tony. I mean, actually, if we have a free, people going about WTO rules, so Trump is talking about smashing the WTO, basically, so there will be no WTO
rules.
Well,
he's pulling out of everything, isn't he?
He's pulling out of everything. Now, basically, British farming was inefficient from the moment in 1888 when the Dunedin docked in the port of London with cheaper lamb from New Zealand than could be produced in Britain. And British farming, basically, in an international competitive environment, shouldn't be there. Yeah. I mean, basically, we can buy our stuff cheaper from men all over the world. We don't have to buy. The only reason we have farming is because of World War One and World War Two, and it became, oh, we better grow some of our own food in case there's a blockade. But in terms of the free market, it's a non-starter.
But I mean, this is
makes me laugh with all these farmers who are in favour of Brexit.
This National Farmers Union saying we're going to run out of food, and The Guardian, it's a bit. I mean, it is.
It's an exaggeration.
It is definitely Project Fear. But I mean, they're implying that there's going to be some sort of blockade.
Well, listen, haven't you noticed that there's going to be trade wars? We're going to have to decide. There's going to be a trade war between the EU and America, and we're going to have to decide which side we're on. And if we decide we're on the American side, then obviously the EU will blockade. What the Americans want is they want to use Britain as a backdoor into the EU. So they want to have lower standards in Britain, but they'll still have access to the market. The EU aren't going to accept that. So if we go with the American side in this trade war, because that's what it is, the EU will be at war with us, and they will blockade us, just as we will blockade them in order to help the Americans to win.
Okay.
That's what's going on out there.
A father died weighing just 6 stone, that's 38 kilos, days before he was due to appeal a decision to refuse him benefits. This is sort of thing is absolutely disgusting. Apparently there's £87 million hole, as almost a third of DLA claimants are refused personal independent payments that they're entitled to. And I emphasise that they're entitled to. So basically what's happening is, because of 2008 and this government's policies, people are getting it in the neck of the disabled, the weakest people in society.
Yeah, and they've got no real power under the electoral system. These people have no real power. Elections in this country are decided by a few thousand voters in swing constituencies around London. And if you're a disabled person in a, you know, unless you're living in one of those constituencies, your vote doesn't count. And of course that means they can carry on doing it, because the people who vote tend to be the wealthier, and ultimately that's what they want.
Okay, finally, Northern Ireland. There's actually been protests this week to mark Northern Ireland breaking the record for the longest period ever without a formal government. Stormont closed down, and I wonder if the people propping up Theresa May in Westminster, the DUP, have got anything to do with this, Martin.
Well, both sides are determined not to have it. And don't forget there was direct rule in Northern Ireland from 1972 until the peace agreement. So, in actual facts, you know, that's not quite the case. They were without a local government from 1972 until the Good Friday Agreement. What's happened since then is that, you know, they've gone back a step instead of forward a step.
Well, then, no. What they're saying is since the Good Friday Agreement.
Yes, but I mean, there was a whole long period when they had no local government at all, because Britain had to take complete control to prevent the whole situation falling to pieces.
It's been something like 2 years since there's been any government in Northern Ireland, and there's no real explanation.
Yeah, but but that's because, to be honest with you, Sinn Féin do not want to take responsibility for the austerity policy that was pursued by the government. So if you want to close down stuff, you're going to do it yourself. We're not going to do it for you.
Time for the Murdoch News at 7. Thanks to our guest, Labour MP for Bristol North West, Darren Jones. Join us after the news.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.